Hello, and welcome to Marching On, the podcast brought to you by the ACLU of Kansas. I'm Mike Kubik, Executive Director of the ACLU of Kansas, and we thank you for listening. If you've been following any of our legal cases, or even just watched a TV court show in your life, you know that our court systems can move painfully slowly. Between filings, hearings, and, most excruciating of all, waiting for a ruling, cases can easily go on for years, with many months between substantive updates. Sometimes, though, the stars align, and you can get sudden updates in multiple cases quickly. This month is one of those times. Our first conversation for this episode is with D.C. Hegert, an attorney and legal fellow here at the ACLU of Kansas. D.C. is taking the lead on an important case the affiliate filed, challenging SB 63, the law the state legislature passed to restrict medical freedom for trans youth in Kansas. In the first conversation in this episode, they share a deeper dive into that case, the law it is challenging, and the larger fight for trans and LGBTQ plus rights. Now, not long after we wrapped that conversation, the courts announced rulings in a few cases that are very pertinent to this issue. So we called DC right back into the studio to give some insight into those developments, which included a substantive ruling that would stop Attorney General Chris Kobach from denying gender marker changes on Kansas driver's licenses. You'll hear both of those conversations with DC back-to-back in the first half of the podcast. After that, we'll shift gears, moving from the courthouse to our communities, as we highlight the work of Kansans who participated in the national ACLU's Freedom to Be monument. This monument was installed on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and featured quilts made by people all over the nation, a symbol to spell out the phrase, Freedom to Be. Two Kansans who helped lead the creation of panels for the project join us to share more about this project and their work. For that segment, we'll hear from Ray, an activist from Cimarron in western Kansas, and Sam, an artist from Lawrence. All of these conversations are moderated by our very own communications manager and multimedia guru, Jesse Kielman. So let's dive right in and listen to Jesse in conversation with DC Hegert.
DC Hegert, thank you so much for joining us today to tell us about Lowe v. Kansas, the latest lawsuit brought by the ACLU of Kansas to challenge the newly passed SB 63.
Do you just want to give us the details on what was included in the bill and why we're challenging it?
Yeah, for sure. So unfortunately, in the 2025 legislative session in Kansas, one of the first bills they passed was a bill called SB 63, which what it does in essence is bans certain types of gender-affirming health care only for transgender minors in the state of Kansas. It has specific carve-outs where the same exact health care that they're banning for trans kids is still allowed in the state of Kansas for cisgender children or intersex kids. So it's banning things like puberty blockers or hormone treatment therapies that have been, you know, used for decades and are the best practiced medicine that every major medical association recommends trans youth are able to access. And every major medical association is opposing these types of bills. But unfortunately, SB 63 passed over Governor Kelly's veto this legislative session, and it took effect almost immediately. Instead of taking effect when it was entered in the statute books at the end of the summer, it took effect during legislative session, so in February of this year.
How unusual is that?
You know, it's unfortunately becoming more common where the legislators are amending some of these more harmful bills to have language that says they take effect essentially when they are entered into the registrar's book. So that means like every Thursday that is published. And so as soon as the bill passes, that once that Thursday comes, the law takes effect. And we saw those amendments to language in a number of anti-trans bills in the legislative session. We've seen them try to include that type of provision in some of the anti-reproductive freedom bills as well. So it's unusual, but it's becoming more common as we see some of these more restrictive civil rights bills being pushed. So unfortunately, this healthcare ban has been in effect in Kansas since February of this year. It's targeting trans minors in the state and their families, but it's also targeting Kansas medical providers and threatening them with licensure revocation and lawsuits if they provide the care that's banned in this bill, which is putting medical providers in the state in a bind because the care that's banned is medically necessary and is the best practice healthcare recommended to treat their patients. There's hundreds of trans minors in the state of Kansas that were already accessing this healthcare and were thriving because of it. And now, the largest providers of this care in the state, like Children's Mercy, for example, have stopped completely providing this care. And so because of how we saw this law play out since February and just kind of the scope of harm that we were seeing in the state, the affiliate, along with ACLU national attorneys, decided that we should bring a lawsuit in Kansas to challenge this bill. And so we brought a lawsuit under the Kansas state constitution. So we filed in state court in Douglas County, challenging SB 63 as unconstitutional. And we're seeking what's called a temporary injunction, which essentially means if we win on that motion, this law would be paused. And so it would no longer be in effect in Kansas. And these families and these children could access the care that they need while our lawsuit plays out, essentially.
That was a great explanation. I know we get a lot of questions on the temporary injunction. So basically, the temporary injunction is an argument about what's in effect until it's ultimately decided, right?
Yeah, it's essentially a pre-decision on the actual merits of the case. So like, we are arguing in our lawsuit that this law is unconstitutional because it violates, you know, Kansas constitutional rights about equal protection and about fundamental rights to parenting. And the temporary injunction is essentially saying, hey, court, we are likely going to win on these arguments, but this law is already causing so much harm and violating Kansan civil rights that we should pause the law from taking effect and causing any further harm while the rest of the lawsuit plays out. So it's kind of really like a pre-ruling on the full constitutional arguments of the case so that we can get immediate relief because, you know, the harm is already ongoing.
Yeah. That makes total sense. Thank you. Because this has been in effect since February, what have we seen in terms of what it looks like to have it in place right now?
Yeah, I mean, so we can talk about that kind of anecdotally through the lens of our Doe plaintiff. So we have two families that are our clients in this lawsuit. It's called Lowe v. Kansas. And, you know, one of them is a family with a 13-year-old trans daughter. Another is a family with a 16-year-old trans son. And both of those kids were receiving the healthcare that is banned by SB 63. You know, the 13-year-old girl, for example, was receiving puberty blockers to pause, you know, male puberty so that they could navigate their transition and coming into their gender. We all are navigating a lot of stuff when we're, you know, 12, 13, 14.
You're telling me. And so, I am 31.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that care is really necessary so that these kids can develop and come into themselves in that age. And our 16-year-old client, he was accessing testosterone because, you know, he's 16 years old. That's when we're going through puberty. So that's, he needed hormone replacement therapy so that he could go through, you know, the appropriate male puberty for him. And so when SB 63 took effect in February, both of these families, they were receiving healthcare from the Children's Mercy Gender Pathways Clinic, which is a gender affirming healthcare clinic out of the Children's Mercy Hospital. And unfortunately, the hospital policy that took effect after this law passed was to stop providing this care completely for these families. That means that, you know, our 13-year-old client was not able to receive the puberty blocker shot that she was supposed to get at the end of May. And that means that our 16-year-old client wasn't able to keep getting his testosterone script filled, which he's supposed to, you know, maintain those shots weekly.
You know, like medicine.
Yeah, like how medicine works, you know. And so that obviously was happening to our two clients, their children, and impacting their families. But that was also happening to the hundreds of other trans minors in the state of Kansas that were accessing this care either through Children's Mercy or through other healthcare providers in the state of Kansas. And so, you know, what that means immediately for these families in the months between February and us filing this lawsuit is that they were kind of frantically looking for ways to maintain this medically necessary healthcare for their kids. You know, for some families, this has been life-saving healthcare that has really helped turn around their children's mental health and their physical health and like have given these kids their lives back. And so these families were, you know, really terrified about what it means if they're not able to maintain this care. So they've been, you know, having to look at out-of-state healthcare providers in states that don't have these bans to be able to access this care. And that means, you know, for our clients, they're traveling to Colorado or Minnesota to maintain, you know, to find providers that are able to give them scripts to maintain this care. And that's obviously a huge burden. It's cost prohibitive. You have to be able to travel. You have to be able to take off time to take your kid out there. So there's obviously a lot of burdens that are being placed on these families. These are loving parents that just want the best for their children. So they're trying to navigate all of these barriers to be able to access this care. But it's hard. And also there's a lot of families that financially or otherwise are just not able to make it out of state to get these care networks in place for their kids. So, you know, there's some families that are able to get care in these other states while this ban's in effect. And there's some families that unfortunately are stuck in Kansas and their kids are either forced to detransition if they've been on this healthcare that's banned, you know, for years. Now they just all of a sudden can't access it. Or if it's trans youth that were wanting to start this type of healthcare, they are just unable to start that care in the state of Kansas.
What might one expect from either starting these medications and then be forced to quit, or even more broadly, I mean, a talking point is, oh, just wait until you're 18 and then you can make the decision or whatever, which to your point on puberty seems to ignore, you know, the human body and how it works. So I didn't know if you wanted to speak a little bit more at mental, physical, all the medical kind of harms or concerns that come from being denied this care.
Yeah. I mean, I'll point out that we have the filings that we've entered in the Loewe Kansas lawsuit on the ACLU of Kansas website. And they talk quite a bit about, you know, what gender dysphoria is, what it means to be trans, what this type of gender affirming healthcare is and what it does. And so for folks that want to really, really read about it, they can check out our filings. But I will just kind of talk generally. One, I want to say that what we're talking about in this lawsuit is not surgeries. So often when people that push these anti-trans healthcare bans, they're talking about surgery. And the large majority of gender-affirming healthcare that's given to minors is not surgery. It is things like social transitioning affirmation, allowing a trans kid to use a different name, allowing them to present you know, in the clothes that they wear, with the haircut that they have, you know, a different gender expression.
Would that be covered by this bill as well?
So unfortunately, SB 63 does have provisions talking about social transitioning in certain contexts. And so we're concerned about how broad SB 63 is written and really what that impact is going to look like on the ground. Our lawsuit is really focused on the medical care ban provisions, but you know, we are concerned about the broad harm that could come from this bill, or just sort of the kind of climate of fear it will create for like both medical and mental health providers in Kansas.
And that seems like such a defining quality of these bills. Plural, the actual consequences always seem broad and such that it forces people to be quite cautious because you don't really know where it ends.
Yeah, I mean, so many of these bills are written, like the one in Kansas, to invite lawsuits against professionals that are violating the letter of the law, or in some states, you know, inviting criminal penalties against these people. And so, yeah, it creates this kind of environment of fear and sort of a lot of cautiousness in providers and professionals that may be implicated by the bills. And so that is obviously a concern. And it also just creates like a harmful environment of social rhetoric where, you know, people are debating trans people's lives, trans kids' bodies. And, you know, that amount of scrutiny is not healthy. There's tons of studies that have shown just the introduction of these bills and the rhetoric around them impacts queer and trans youth's mental health. And then when what the laws are doing is making it harder for these trans young people to access affirming mental health therapists or affirming medical providers, that's a huge concern, because not only are these bills increasing the problems of mental health distress and sort of social acceptance among trans people, but they're also limiting their resources to deal with these issues.
I'd be curious if you know of any examples of healthcare providers leaving the state because of bills like this, but I know we've seen that elsewhere and in other examples where it's maybe not an anti-trans bill that was passed, but other restrictive bills where you see professionals in those domains leave the state because it's not vocationally worth it to deal with those hazards.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have seen providers back away from offering gender-affirming care because they're concerned about what it would do for their practice, about their, you know, potential to lose their license. The issue broadly is that, removed from the rhetoric that we talk about, should trans people have this care? What type of care should they have access to? Should it be illegal? Removed from this sort of political discussion that exists, there's actually a way broader problem of access in general to competent healthcare providers. There's not a ton of gender-affirming care providers in the state of Kansas, period. Before these bills were passed, there was already huge access gaps. Removed from the context of trans people, in the state of Kansas, we are a rural state that has healthcare equity issues, period. It's hard for people in rural parts of our state to access full practice medicine and the healthcare that they need. And I'm talking about cisgender people. I mean, so that was already an issue in a state like Kansas. And then it makes it even harder when trans people need sort of more nuanced care and need healthcare providers that are competent in the specific types of gender affirming care, you know, that are necessary for trans folks to medically transition. And it's making it even harder because now providers, I mean, because of this law, are unable to give the care. But there are, you know, it's creating an environment where they don't even necessarily want to get engaged with this type of care because of, you know, what that could mean for their practice, what that could mean for their licensure. And then on top of that, it's hard to get med students to want to come to Kansas to grow our provider population and address not only the equity and access issues for the trans population, but for our entire state when our legislature is passing laws in this context and in other contexts that are telling medical providers what they can and can't do when medical providers are the ones that are the experts. This is medically necessary best practice healthcare that Kansas families are choosing to provide for their children with their medical providers, with informed consent. You know, they're having nuanced discussions with their healthcare team about this decision and making it for their family and deciding this is the best choice for their children. And then after having gone through those entire processes, have this care ripped away from them. That is just constitutionally not right. But removed from that, like what that means for these trans young people in our state is that, you know, some of them have been, you know, living their entire lives as the person they are. You know, like, for example, our 13-year-old client has been living, you know, majority of her life as a girl. Everyone in the community knows her as a girl. All of the people in her world know her as a girl. And she's been on puberty blockers so that she didn't have to undergo any type of male puberty. And now, because this law has taken effect, ripping that away from her and threatening, you know, if her family's not able to establish out-of-state care networks, threatening her to have to go through male puberty and really potentially force her to be outed, you know, in all these contexts. And she's been living her life happily, successfully, healthily as a girl for so long. And so, you know, that's just one example of the harm this has, both in a mental way, but also in a physical way. You know, their body's going to go through these changes that, you know, they've been specifically avoiding and been on this medicine to make sure they don't have to undergo. And now, just because some politicians in Topeka decided this care shouldn't be accessed only by trans kids, these families are having to go through this. Meanwhile, cisgender children in the state of Kansas that are going through, say, precocious puberty, like, for example, a young girl, a cisgender girl who starts puberty at a really young age, starts to develop, you know, like breasts at a really young age.
I know there are girls that like will have their first period at like 8 or 9, yeah, way before like would fall in that example,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so these puberty blockers that we're talking about trans minors using are also prescribed to cisgender children for a number of different medical reasons. Precocious puberty is just one of them. Mm-hmm. But those cisgender children in the state of Kansas can still access the very same medicine that now our 13 and 16-year-old clients don't have access to. And so not only is it causing these mental and medical health issues, but it's also just that is so unfair. Like, you know, you could explain that to, you know, an elementary school child and they would understand that's unjust. You know, that is a violation of equal protection because this group of people gets this medicine and this group of people doesn't. And the only reason is because they're transgender. And the family should be able to make those choices together.
One of the misconceptions I hear the most is just how thoughtful the process for transition is. I'll say typically, I guess, but it seems to be near universal where first you usually socially transition where you start using maybe a different name, different pronouns, maybe just, you know, like you said, hair, clothes, whatever, but no medical intervention at that point, right?
Right.
And then if after you do that for a while, because that's where too, like people are like, well, what if it's just a phase? And it's like, you know, my fedora phase lasted, right, like 6 weeks or whatever. And then you start getting into maybe puberty blocker territory where you can delay some of the effects and the medical risk of that seem near non-existent. The most I saw was much later in life, like in your 60s or 70s, your bone density might be statistically lower than the median for your demographic or whatever, which feels like a pretty fair trade-off. And then you start talking like estrogen, testosterone, right? And typically, like you said too, like the concern that gets billboarded the most is something like a surgical intervention, and that is it never or near never happens before.
I'm unaware of providers in Kansas that will do gender-affirming surgeries on minors, and that's really not happening in the state of Kansas. What we're talking about, you know, when we're talking about transition for young people is everything you just walked through. You know, we're talking about social transitioning, changing your name, your pronouns, your appearance, you know, like as far as your gender expression, your haircut, your clothing. And that's usually happening for a year or two or three before they're doing any sort of medical intervention. And then, you know, the medical intervention that comes is, yeah, puberty suppressants, which is like puberty blockers, so that it gives these youth even more time to figure out, you know, their internal sense of gender, to make sure that everything's aligned, that, you know, who they are feels right as they're going through their journey. Because if you're not able to access puberty blockers or puberty suppressants, then you will start going through puberty related to the sex you were assigned at birth. And oftentimes some of those, you know, changes that occur to your body are irreversible when you start to go through puberty. And so the puberty suppressants just delay that. So that, you know, even if, you know, on the other end of it, the, you know, person that's been going through the process decides, you know, they don't want to go through medical transition, they can still have puberty as the sex they were assigned at birth. It just gave them that window of time to figure that out. And if they, you know, continue to go down the path of, you know, I am transgender and this is who I am and I want to continue with medical transition, then they're able to, you know, start on hormones at the age that most people start puberty and not have had to go through puberty related to the sex assigned at birth and have, you know, secondary sex characteristics that, you know, make it harder for them to feel affirmed in their gender and who they are.
Whether medical care is benign or controversial has very, very little, maybe nothing to do with the care and everything to do with the observer, or just our feelings on it, right?
Like, yeah, truly. And I mean, another thing that I think needs to be said when we're talking about this care, kind of going back to that access and equity piece, is that the percentage of trans people that are able to have both affirming parents and the resources to access gender-affirming healthcare at a young age is such a small group of the total population of trans people that exist. I say that just to make the point that this care should exist and should be around for trans people that are able to access it, but also majority of trans people are, you know, either not able to transition until after they've already gone through the puberty related to their sex assigned at birth, or maybe don't have affirming parents. And so they're not able to come out as trans while they're minors, or they're not able to, you know, have parents that would consent to them accessing this care, either because the parents, you know, don't affirm them, the parents have religious beliefs opposing their transgender identity, whatever it may be, or they just don't have the financial means or access to a competent medical provider that could give them this care. And so there's such a large percentage of trans people that unfortunately are just not even able to access gender-affirming care until into their adulthood. You know, I wasn't able to start medically transitioning until I was in my 20s. It is less common for folks to have this type of care when they're young. that's not right. But because of all those reasons we've already kind of touched on, it's not super accessible. And so it's really not available for that many individuals. And so the fact that we are experiencing this wave of targeting of this care and bans in this space for such a small percentage of the population is really silly in my mind. You know, these resources should not be spent on this issue. There's so much other work we should be having our legislators spend their time on. There you go.
Thank you so much, DC.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time and your enlightenment on this.
Of course. Appreciate it, Jesse.
DC, thank you for joining me again. I know the court system always goes slow. I think it goes faster if you record a podcast and then any updates that make that first recording obsolete will come immediately for you. And so first I want to ask you, I'm sure a lot of people saw the headlines that the Supreme Court did issue their ruling in U.S. versus Scametti, and that could very well have impacts on Kansans. So if you want to kind of give us a little bit of background on the case and the ruling and where that leaves us.
Yeah, for sure. So there's been a lot of litigation across the country challenging gender-affirming healthcare bans for minors. And there was one specific case challenging a law out of Tennessee that was banning healthcare for trans minors in the state called U.S. v. Scametti. And that case was actually argued before the Supreme Court this past winter. And just recently, the Supreme Court issued its ruling in that case. And unfortunately, it was an unfavorable ruling for trans rights advocates. They essentially found that the law did not discriminate based off of the equal protection arguments that the ACLU attorneys were raising in that case. That ruling, it's from the Supreme Court, so it impacts federal court and states as well. However, that ruling was specific to the Tennessee healthcare ban that was passed, and it was also a somewhat narrow ruling in a legal sense that it was focused on certain equal protection arguments, and they did not extend, you know, the ruling that they made on that Tennessee healthcare ban to other trans rights topics. So that is sort of the good news from that ruling, is that it was somewhat of a narrow holding. So there's space for advocates to continue to advance trans rights in different contexts. And I also want to name that, you know, while that ruling could impact Kansas, the ACLU of Kansas has recently brought its own state court litigation challenging the trans youth healthcare ban that was passed in Kansas.
The other thing to keep in mind is Scametti is a ruling on U.S. Constitution. Like you said, there's a lot of limitations around that. But in terms of when we think about legal protections, you have the protections from the U.S. Constitution, but then you also additionally have the state constitution ones. So the U.S. Constitution is the floor, and then it goes up from there depending on your state's protections, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's some rights from state constitutions that are really similar to the rights that are found in the federal constitution. But in some states, like Kansas, there are some rights in our state constitution that are actually more protective than the rights in the federal constitution. And so, you know, the bodily autonomy protections that exist in the Kansas constitution is one of those areas where we believe that the Kansas constitution actually has stronger and broader protections than the federal constitution. And so the ACLU of Kansas, along with our partners at ACLU National, have recently filed a lawsuit challenging SB 63, which was a law that passed the previous legislative session in Kansas, attempting to ban certain types of gender-affirming healthcare only for trans minors in the state. And so we filed a state court challenge under the Kansas Constitution, you know, arguing that SB 63 is unconstitutional under the Kansas Constitution. And so even though we've had this somewhat negative ruling that came down from the Supreme Court on a similar bill out of Tennessee, we have our own litigation filed in Kansas that is sort of in a separate legal lane than what the Scametti ruling is. But, you know, we will see how that case unfolds. But we've got great clients and families that are going forward for that lawsuit with us.
In a different case, we just received a preliminary ruling, right?
Yeah, we did. So the ACLU of Kansas, our affiliate, has two different trans rights cases ongoing right now. So we recently filed SB 63 lawsuit, Lowe v. Kansas, which is about trans minors' healthcare. But we also have had a case that's been ongoing for about 2 years now that challenged SB 180 and the ability for trans folks in Kansas to change their gender markers on their state driver's licenses. So the ACLU of Kansas actually intervened in a lawsuit that the Attorney General's office brought against the state of Kansas itself, where the Attorney General was arguing that SB 180, the sex definitions bill that passed in 2023, banned trans people in Kansas from changing the gender marker on their license to match the gender they live as. Essentially, the Attorney General won a temporary injunction order from the district court in that case that instituted a ban on gender marker changes for driver's licenses in Kansas for trans people. We immediately appealed that ruling, and we have been, you know, awaiting an answer from the Court of Appeals on that argument since January of this year. And also very recently, we received a ruling from the Court of Appeals that overturned the temporary injunction that was in place from the district court and essentially said that, you know, the Attorney General did not make enough legal arguments sufficient to have gotten that ban in place. You know, we got this ruling from the Court of Appeals. It's a great ruling. It's really robust. And so now there's sort of a procedural process that has to play out in the court. So that order, that opinion that they ruled in our favor, doesn't take legal effect until a mandate is issued from the court. The Attorney General essentially has the right to appeal the Court of Appeals ruling up to the Kansas Supreme Court, which is our highest state court. And he can essentially argue that the Court of Appeals got it wrong and that his temporary injunction ban should have stayed in place. The Attorney General has stated publicly since this ruling came out that he intends to file a petition with the Supreme Court to review this case. We have not seen that petition be filed yet, but that will essentially pause the Court of Appeals mandate from issuing, which means that order where we won at the Court of Appeals doesn't take legal effect right away. To cut through all this legalese, what happens on the ground for trans people in Kansas trying to change their gender marker on a license is right now, KDOR and the DMVs in our state have not been given legal authority to start changing gender markers. However, they may be able to get that legal authority soon. It depends on a number of things that happen procedurally. The Attorney General has said he's going to file this petition. He has 30 days to do so from the time of our opinion being granted. If he doesn't file a petition in that window of time, after the 30 days passes, the mandate will issue and then KDOR will be able to start changing gender markers again. If he does file a petition with the Supreme Court, then it will depend on how the Kansas Supreme Court handles it, what will happen with KDOR and gender marker changes in Kansas. In the interim, the Kansas Supreme Court could decline to review the Court of Appeals ruling. So just because the Attorney General files a petition for a review with the Supreme Court doesn't mean they have to grant it. If they do that, then the mandate would issue and KDOR could change gender markers. Or the Supreme Court could decide to accept the case for review. And if they do that, there is some arguments that we may be able to make that the temporary injunction ban that the district court granted shouldn't remain in place while this appeals process is ongoing. So there's a number of kind of procedural things that the Kansas Supreme Court could do if the Attorney General files this appeal. But the short answer right now, the DMVs are not changing gender markers, but depending on what happens with the Attorney General's office and the Kansas Supreme Court, there may be a world where soon we will be able to change those gender markers. If we win at the Kansas Supreme Court level and they say the Court of Appeals got it right, this temporary injunction should not have been granted, then the mandate will issue. And from that point on, trans people can change their gender markers in Kansas while the rest of this lawsuit unfolds. And so, you know, I would say if you're looking to change your gender marker on your driver's license in Kansas or correct it if it got reverted back during the span of this ban, keep an eye on the ACLU of Kansas's social media. We will be giving updates on this case as it unfolds. And as soon as we know what's going on, we will be updating the community as it unfolds. We understand how important this is to the trans community in Kansas. And so we'll be making sure that we can keep folks up to date. As soon as we know something, you know, the community will know something. At the same time as us receiving this good ruling in Harper, there's been some changes happening in the federal landscape related to passport gender marker changes. This was a federal case. It hasn't yet gone up to the Supreme Court, but it was a federal case that was dealing with, I think folks are pretty familiar that there's been a number of executive orders issued by the Trump administration targeting trans folks' rights. One of those was related to federal identity documents, specifically talking about passports and trans people's ability to change their gender marker on their passport booklets and cards. The ACLU national team, along with some other partners, filed a lawsuit challenging that executive order, and they recently won a preliminary injunction in that case, essentially barring the executive order from taking effect. And so what that means on the ground for folks across the country who may be wanting to get a passport, update their passport, correct their passport if they've had the wrong gender marker on it, is that now the State Department is barred from complying with the executive order that was banning gender marker changes. So it means the State Department should now be allowing trans people to self-designate their gender marker on their passport. And the extra bonus good news there is not only can you self-designate your gender marker, but you can choose between an M, an F, or an X gender marker on your federal passport or passport booklet or passport ID card. This ruling just recently came down in the middle of June. And so the ACLU National Resources is going to be a great place for people to look at to figure out what's unfolding with the State Department. ACLU National, you know, is recommending folks wait until we have updates from the State Department on how they're processing passport applications in light of this ruling. But the legal holding is that trans people now must be able to self-select their gender marker, M, F, or X. And I will note, if you're a trans person, for example, in Kansas, who's trying to apply for a federal passport that has the correct gender marker, you do not have to have state documentation that verifies that gender marker. So, you know, Kansas has a birth certificate gender marker change ban right now. And so if your birth certificate that you have to show for your federal passport application has your sex assigned at birth on it, that's not going to bar you from utilizing this preliminary injunction ruling to change your gender marker on your federal ID. So if folks are interested or looking to update their passport or get a new passport with the correct gender marker, keep an eye on ACLU National's resources. They're going to be sharing updates about this preliminary injunction win and guidance for the community related to what they hear from the State Department in the coming weeks.
Awesome. Thank you for that update, DC.
That was great.
Of course. Anything else you wanted to make sure we touched on?
I don't think so. Just happy Pride.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, DC. Happy Pride.
Many thanks to DC for sharing those insights with us. Now, let's go over to Ray and Sam to share more about the Freedom to Be Project.
My name is Ray View. I use he, him pronouns. I live in a very rural part of Southwest Kansas, and I identify as a trans man.
I know kind of the thing that brought us together was the Freedom to Be Project. How did you get involved, and kind of what did your involvement look like?
So I work with the LGBT Foundation of Kansas. I'm the president of the board right now. DC had emailed our executive director. And as soon as I saw that email, I was like, Matthew, I have to be involved with this. I think this is awesome. In that email, they specifically talked about we want rural people to be involved in this project because a lot of times we're not represented very well in Kansas and especially nationwide. I feel like there are people here, like my friends and trans people that I know in the area who need to be represented in some way. We live very different lives than a lot of other queer people. We have very dispersed communities. It's hard to meet people. It's hard to like get to know people in your community. And a lot of times we're surrounded by people who might be supportive, but are not queer. So we don't have the kind of tight communities that other people have. We also don't have places to go. So like we don't have gay bars. We don't have supportive coffee shops. We don't have a downtown area where people fly pride flags. We just don't have that at all.
Do you still live in the small town where you grew up then?
I lived here until I was 18, and then I went to college. And then my partner and I moved to another small town around here. And then just maybe like a year, year and a half ago, we moved back to the farm that I actually grew up at.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Has that presented any challenges just being in a community where you existed maybe differently before?
I thought it would be more challenging than it has been. I think it's actually maybe a little bit easier for people to humanize us. They know we're good people. They know who our family is. They've interacted with us in the past. Already having connections with people I think has helped them just understand that, like, we're just doing the best thing we can too. Like, we're trying to live here and fit in. And I just want to go to a coffee shop like you, you know. There have been, you know, obviously people who just absolutely do not want us to be here. But for the most part, it's actually been fairly good.
I'm really happy to hear that.
It's easier for people to humanize us. A lot of the queer people who grew up here move because they faced a lot of discrimination as kids and they don't want to be anything around that. And like, I went through those experiences as well. But to me, this is where I want to live and I'm going to live here regardless of how people treat me. And like, I've had a lot of people, like business owners and things, message me privately and be like, hey, we support you. We just can't publicly like fly a pride flag or whatever. And there's been so many people do that I'm like, well, why don't you all just get together and make the town better? Because there's enough of you that I feel like you would support each other enough that it wouldn't actually be that big of a problem. I had joined like a Kansas Facebook support group just to like meet other people. And the owner of that group, I started talking to him and found out that he's actually from my small town. So I found that out and we got to talking and he kind of presented this like vision of what he was wanting to do. And I'm like, yep, I'm in.
Can I hear more about that organization? And maybe off of that, there's other organizations or other advocacy that you do just kind of broadly?
So the LGBT Foundation of Kansas started maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. And I was kind of in it from the beginning. So kind of what he sold it on to me was that he wants to help lower the suicide rate of queer people in Kansas. And his kind of ideas behind that were that, especially in Southwest Kansas, we don't have connections to each other and we don't have connections to resources. So connect people to each other. And by doing that, you're also gaining resources because we all have something to offer. We all have, you know, talents and skills and money and things that we can offer to each other. If we build that connection up, we can actually support each other through crisis and things like that. That really hit me because I had volunteered on suicide hotline all through college, like thousands of hours on the suicide hotline. And that's like a big passion of mine is crisis intervention work. So that kind of got me involved in that. And then since then we've, you know, built up a board and we try to hit all the pride events and we do all kinds of work. And we probably don't get as much visibility as a lot of groups in Kansas that do like LGBT advocacy because we don't really focus on political issues. We're more focused on connecting people to each other. I do work with New Frontiers, which is a division of Loud Light for Southwest Kansas. And a lot of what I'm involved in is putting on pride events. And I've spoken at a couple of pride events out here. And then we also do some immigration protections. So I'm really proud of the work that that organization is doing and that I can support it.
Can I hear about your participation in the Freedom to Be Quilt and maybe your experience with it too?
What the beginnings of the project looked like for us was just trying to contact as many people, rural Kansans, as I possibly could. Say, hey, are you interested in this? Who else do you know that might be interested? And we had quite a few people reaching out being like, I love this idea. We came up with an idea. One of my friends pitched this idea of like, he was a new dad at the time. And we were talking about like, how do we feel safe in this area? And he mentioned the idea of like family bathrooms, somewhere where we can take our kids to go to the bathroom. And I kind of drew up a little sketch and was like, oh, I love this idea. So we came with this idea of like, we can put people on the bathroom sign. I'll just send like blank fabric to whoever wants to participate in the area. Everybody can make their own like little person. So that's kind of how it came together is like I did the background and all the sewing and everybody else pitched in to make like little people to go on it. We have, you know, a great diversity of people who are farmers and gardeners and all kinds of things. So it's hard to get everybody actually physically together, but it was a really good experience.
What kind of gives you hope or what motivates you to get involved in these things and just the work writ large?
Yeah, that's kind of a difficult question to answer. I was at a protest a couple weeks ago and, you know, you just talk to people at a protest. There was an older lady who asked me like, do you have hope? And I said, I wouldn't be here if I didn't have hope. And I don't know that I have a reason to feel hope other than looking at the people in our history who didn't have hope either and still got to work and made some change. Because we could still be in very bad situations if enslaved people hadn't freed themselves, if LGBT people hadn't fought back against police brutality, if Black people hadn't fought back against police brutality, we could be in incredibly bad situations. But if people found hope within themselves that things could change, and I'm hopeful that things can change too, even though, you know, a lot of days I wake up and I'm like, ugh, everything's bad, everything sucks, I don't want to get up. Well, everything's bad, everything sucks, that's all of human history. And you still have to get up and try to make it better. And there's always, so Dodge City and Garden City, these kind of small towns, both have Pride events now and have for several years. And there's always those people who show up, who are shouting on the corner, yelling slurs and Bible verses and whatever. And they always leave early. They never stay the whole event because they don't actually care.
Mm-hmm.
They're just there to take their picture and yell for a little bit and feel like they did something. And they'll leave and we can go on with our day.
Sam, can I just open it up? Can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So, hi, my name is Sam Deming. I use they, them, theirs pronouns. I've always been an artist. I mean, ever since I was, you know, taking my markers and crayons and drawing on the wall when I was younger. So that has always been a very large part of my life. In my childhood, I moved around a lot. So I lived in a lot of different places throughout the Midwest, mainly in Wisconsin and Illinois. But when I finally left high school, after going through the tumultuousness that is high school, coming out as both initially, right, like bisexual, pansexual, queer, and then finding out I was trans, and then all the steps, all the things that happened in college is really where I started to flourish and was really able to start thinking about my values, the things that I wanted to fight for and believe in and all those things, especially from my childhood experiences. So that's where I really started focusing a lot more on my artwork, but also a lot more on what do I believe in? What are those things that truly then turned into the activism pieces for me? So I have a bachelor's in fine arts from the University of Wisconsin, Whitewater. And from there, I was really like, okay, I'm not done with school, but what do I do? And so that's how I ended up at the University of Kansas for grad school. And that's where I got my master's of higher education administration. So helping folks in college, just like somebody helped me out in college, especially as like a first generation student. I've stayed in Kansas. This is where I met my wife at, where we got married, where I have found home and community and want to fight for that home and community.
It's really cool hearing how art has been such a part of your life. Can you tell me more about maybe what your art looks like now and just what you're doing with it?
Yeah. So especially going through high school into college, it was of the concept of like having to create like fine, high art, gallery ready art. And that's what you do as an artist. Never really sat well with me because I felt like that was super like elitist and gross. I think from going through that experience and then to what my art is now, I try to really focus on identity, community, some more of that, right? Like you should care, right? Like this is why you should care about these things. This is the joy in these communities, the joy that we can take in, right? Finding ourselves and in all those pieces. I also, of course, then focus on like things that I enjoy, which is like horror and pop culture and stuff like that. So I guess currently right now I've been selling at a lot of like local drag shows, which has been really fun because it's like, here's a drag show, but then also here's this random artist selling things. So that has been a really neat experience recently. It's kind of a mishmash right now, but I have a lot of plans for focusing my art more specifically on, I think, the social commentary of the everything that is going on right now. Last year, I did one that was more higher education focused that I presented at a national conference of an organization that I'm a part of called ACPA. And that piece really focused on almost the conversation of like, I don't want to be having this conversation in 100 years. How about we just like, I don't know, give trans people their rights like right now. A lot of it also had images or imagery of like textbooks or reports or new dissertations or whatever that literally said, hey, save our centers, or the disappearance of your local LGBT center. What has this impact had on XYZ? And, you know, not even 5 months later, the LGBT center at my local university closed, as we've seen them close throughout the country. So it was almost like this weird predictive moment, but anybody could have predicted that to happen because of the state of the world that we were even in last year. and into now. So I think with some current projects I'm working on, I tried to shift it a little bit into something that sounded more fun. That was like a tarot series. And so I'm working on one right now called Lavender and Blood. And that's going to be more like post-apocalyptic, but how these characters that I would draw within the series really are able to band together and survive. I've even forgot to mention last October, I also did a series. It was a horror queer series. It was called It Came from the Closet, based on a book of short stories by the same name. So I was very inspired by that. But I was like, that's such a good flipping title. I'm going to steal it. But it's called It Came from the Closet and Growing Up a Queer Monster. And so this series of like 10, 11-ish paintings all came from the notion of, okay, well, if you're going to see me as a monster, right, being trans, being queer, being whatever, then I'm going to show you a flipping monster, right? So there's one piece that I have that it's literally closet doors, and you see like two like glowing red eyes, and then there's like a hand that's coming out, but it has like these very fierce, highly painted nails and stuff. There's another piece that I have where it's a girl looking in the mirror. And there's a little post-it note on the mirror that says, like, don't forget to take your meds. And on the counter, you can see there's a couple different things. But then you see, like, progesterone, like a prescription on the counter. But you also see her turning into this almost, like, werewolf-like creature. And so it's kind of this moment of, like, okay, I'm going to play on this because we know how horror has had such an impact on queer folks, queer community. That's how queer folks have expressed themselves through horror. And here's now what this felt like, or what I know to be of what I felt like growing up, being queer and feeling so different from my peers. So yeah, a lot of things.
That's so cool. So how did you get involved with the Freedom to Be project then?
Yeah. So here in Lawrence, there is a organization called the Trans Lawrence Coalition, and I have quite a few friends who are part of it. I would say that I'm a part of it as like a member, but I was approached by one of my close friends who's a part of the organization, who said, hey, we're working with this project with the ACLU. We need artists who want to be a part of this. I think they also posted on their Instagram about it as well. And I was like, I need to be a part of this. I would love to. Any way that I can like use my art for good or for some sort of anything, I was like, you know, I want to do that. And so I kind of went in with that notion of, okay, I'm going to create this overall image. It's just going to be the outline, because they were going to try and have different events for other people to add to the banner so they could fill in, whether it be the colors on the image or anything else they want to add. So the image that I created, I took a quote that I had used on another previous piece of mine, being only I get to define my existence and I exist defiantly. And so I put that in the middle, and kind of around that, I was like, you know, this is supposed to be a community piece. And what are those pieces that I want to make sure are represented, right? So how am I representing disability? How am I representing BIPOC folks? So really thinking about intersectionality and what are ways that people could see themselves within this piece, right? Within this banner. How can we collectively define our existence and exist defiantly? That's how the outline came about. But from there, really everything that was added since then was truly a community project from there. So there was two different events to have folks add to the piece. A lot of that was mainly using markers and colors. People took thread and added some embroidery pieces to it. A lot of like doodles that folks had added around the side to it, which I thought was really sweet and cool that they felt like, okay, cool, I can also make this piece my own. So that was really neat. But within that, I think is where a lot of folks really took it from there and was like, I'm going to add anything that I can onto this. Following that, there was still some pieces that could like be filled in more. So I had, because I work at a university, right? I know a lot of students and a lot of queer trans students that really also wanted to be part of the project. So there's another artist, his name's Rain. He took the banner from there. To me, I really think of them as the second artist on the banner. So gave them the opportunity to fill that in to whatever they wanted to create from there, thus giving us the final banner.
It's really cool to hear how enthusiastic community members were to participate. What did you kind of see from them as they participated?
Yeah, I think because it was so open to sort of interpretation, right? Like, yes, there's this quote, and then here's these like few people that are already drawn, but then people were like, okay, I'm going to add in my own person. I'm going to add in my own self-portrait. I'm going to draw whatever animal I want to put on here to add to that. Here's flowers, here's doodles, here's anything they could think of. And I think that was really exciting to see, is just how every time I would look back at the banner as it was being created, there would be something new. There was some new detail to see that somebody felt, right, like I am a part of this community and feel like I can show myself through this. So I really hope that everybody could look at that and say, I was a part of that, and my piece, whatever I added to it, got to be on the National Mall. Because how many people can say that? Like, that's so cool. But I really hope, most of all, and from what I could see from those two events, is that folks felt not only could they add themselves into it, but that they were also then leaving from that space with community, right? With the idea of there's others around me, that I am not alone in this situation, in this fight, in everything that we are going through, that I can call upon these people again if I ever need to. I really think that that has happened, right, to the great work of organizations like Trans Lawrence Coalition and Trans Joy KC. Those were the two big orgs that helped put on those events.
That's awesome. I'm curious, taking a step back, I just love to hear kind of how you feel art and expression and the community of it too. I mean, that's what I heard a lot coming from you too. So how those play out and maybe their importance right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, right, when we think about what art is, it's of course not solely just here's me painting on a canvas or a banner or whatever. It's all forms of expression, even for myself, right? My gender identity or my gender expression, the way I'm expressing that is art, right? The way that I am putting together myself to be like, hello world, that is an artistic maneuver that I am making the choice to say like, yes, here I'm going to bravely go forward as much as I can to face this world and whatever it's going to throw at me. However, with art in the queer and trans community, within the LGBTQ plus community, it is our motivator. It is our way to come together. It is our way to get through anything that we can. Art is such a tool to navigate this life, no matter what form that art takes vehicle through, right? That could be like actual right, painting, drawing, whatever. That is singing. That is doing karaoke. That is drag. Of course, that is drag. Like, that is why protecting drag is so flipping important, right? Whether it's the makeup skills that go with that or truly anything else, any music, any form of expression that our community can do for one another to build up that community, to express ourselves, to be able to show to the rest of the world, this is why this is so important. This is why this is so vital, or why this is so vital that we have our rights or have the protections and freedoms that everybody else does, is because we have a life to live and we deserve to live that life just as much as anybody else, especially when we think back to like queer culture and the way that that has continued to thrive and envelop the community around it, right? Everybody can feel like they can be a part of that because we come from such a strong history of artists, of artisans, of folks who are able to find that moment of bravery and express themselves in the way that truly makes sense for them, their most authentic selves. That's why art has been so important, especially in an activism way. That's how we can best express ourselves to say, hey, I am here and I'm not going away, right? Especially as we think about mainstream media, the shows that we watch, the books that we read, all those things, the more representation that we can put into that, the more lived experiences and stories of the LGBTQI plus community that we can share, that folks can relate to and see themselves within, even if they maybe aren't queer in themselves, they can at least see, wow, this person is, they're just like me. They want to fall in love. They want to have a life. They want to do all the same things I want to do. Boy, howdy, why are we taking away their rights? That's really goofy.
I mean, you said it earlier. It's like, I don't want to be doing this in 100 years.
Absolutely. I think for myself too, when I think about breaking through that barrier, so to speak, right? When folks can feel like, oh, I can do this. I think to a piece that I made, it's currently on display right now in Kansas City at the Zuby Art Center. There's a group out there called No Divide KC, and they're putting on a queer narratives festival right now. But the piece that I have up in there, the piece title is called The Continual Process of Becoming. I lovingly call her Barbara. Barbara is a mannequin that I saved. So this piece, it's a standing mannequin. She doesn't have a head or anything like that. And she has one hand. She's a treat. The paint that she is covered in is like a thermal, like heat reactive paint. Think of like a mood ring. When you touch it, it changes colors. Mm-hmm. And I did that specifically because in the original gallery showing that she was part of, and for this one, I wanted folks to be able to like, let me physically touch this art. Because I wanted folks to be able to see either A, this is how me or society is impacting folks who may be queer, who may be different, who may be whatever it is. I can physically see the changes that I am imposing on this person if I don't allow them to be who they want to be. But also on Barbara is all of my like ramblings and combinations of thoughts that share, I am queer. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. I am Barbara. I am a part of this community. I've felt this. Anything that she is screaming or me as the artist is screaming out into the void, I'm also there screaming too. I'm also right there with it.
I wanted to ask you where you find hope or how you experience hope or just kind of how you see that play out and in your heart and in the world.
Yeah. I think for myself, when I think about hope, especially over this past like year and a half, how I've had to navigate that sense of hopelessness and regaining that hope. A lot of that has been returning back to my art and how am I expressing myself in that way and trying to find what are those different avenues for finding hope within myself. It is easier done after I have been with those that I love, the community that I've cultivated, right? I say my wife because that's just our best descriptor, but my wife is also trans, right? So that is one piece of right, connecting with them and finding hope in our relationship or in our family that we've built and how we will make it through things together. I look to my friends, having a lot of queer and trans friends and saying, you know, what is going on, checking in with them. And that if we're not finding hope from others, how can we create that hope? How can we be that person to say, you know what, I see that you are struggling, me too. How can I help you? I really think that we can only get through this together. And that in itself gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you to Ray and Sam, as well as DC, for joining us for this episode. It's no secret that right now is a scary time for civil liberties, and the LGBTQ+ community has been purposely targeted by those working to erode our rights. It's hard to keep up with the changing landscape and still feel confident in exercising your rights. We want to end this episode by sharing a few resources with you to help you understand and protect your rights. First, there's our LGBTQ+ Advocacy Resources Hub on our website, accessible at www.aclukansas.org, by clicking on the menu under Resources. This is a comprehensive list of resources and guides to help advocate for your rights, all in an accessible format. We'll continue to curate and update these resources through changing circumstances. Secondly, to be the first in the know, please join our email list and follow us on social media. With that, you'll get to be not only in the loop on important developments, but also get important guides and Know Your Rights materials. We have oodles of those Know Your Rights materials available at www.aclukansas.org. One that is of special interest right now is our Know Your Rights When Protesting guide. If you're planning on protesting anytime soon, and many of you are because there's one every weekend to show dissent to the Trump administration's policies, then safety and preparation are vital. If you're planning to hit the streets to make your voice heard, please make a plan to do so as safely as possible. And with that, we conclude this month's episode of Marching On. Thank you for tuning in. For the ACLU of Kansas, I'm Micah Kubik. Until next time, keep marching on.